Chapter 8. Breath. Stormlord. Warning. Cord woke to the feeling of heat washing over his skin. He sat up slowly. Red and orange light flickered in from the view slits. He looked out. Fire washed over War Anvil. The burning wrecks outside nested close, the flames sheeting from their bones, lapping against the War Anvil's hull. Cord felt as though his body had been worked over with an iron bar. The roar of the gun still rang in his ears. He could not hear anything on the vox. He wanted to sleep. The urge was so deep and overwhelming that he felt his eyes begin to close. Sasha was slumped sideways next to him. He could see the crumpled form of Zayd down in the space beneath the turret. It was all very quiet. The flickering wash of flames like the water of a molten sea pressing silently against a sinking ship's porthole. He shook his head to clear it, but that just sent grey blotches dancing on his eyeballs. What had happened? He could remember the disc and the explosion as it had detonated. After that, how long had he been unconscious? He looked at the Auspex screen. It was a blank black, filled with swirling coloured blocks as he woke it. He muttered to the machine, pleading with it to work. It did. Slowly at first, then, with a blink, it showed him the world beyond the hull. Heat blooms swelled and pulsed across it. He could see the shapes of wreckage, lots of wreckage, each chunk outlined in heat. There was nothing else. He shifted the view wider, but the heat-drowned desolation just grew. He keyed the vox. Static first, then a silence which seemed to wait for him to speak. He licked his lips, suddenly aware that his mouth was dry.
All units, he began. This is War Anvil.
He trailed away. Was the rest of his crew even alive? He looked at the air supply levels. Thrown, they were low. He switched to a total band broadcast.
This is War Anvil. If you can hear, respond.
From somewhere deeper in War Anvil's hull, he heard a clank as something metal unlocked. A second later, a masked face looked up at him.
Sir?
Said a female voice over the vox. It was barely a croak.
Shornell?
He asked, and the sponson gunner nodded.
Oh, is no one else?
He began. She gave the sketch of a shrug.
I don't know, sir. It's been quiet for a while, since the shooting stopped.
Did we take any damage?
No, I don't.
She just sat down then, slumping to the floor.
Shornell,
he said, putting every scrap of strength and calm into her name. Her head jerked up towards him. Her eyes were veined blotches behind the suit lenses.
Damage,
he asked, speaking the word clearly.
I don't think so.
She swayed where she sat.
But the engine went quiet a while ago. I don't know why.
Her head nodded, then came up sharply as though jerked by a string.
Sir,
she added in a smudged voice. Cord blinked as what she had said soaked into him. If the engines were down, then the air supply was running on reserve power. His thoughts were running like thick oil. He blinked and brought his hand up to his face. The gloved fingers filled his eyes. He tapped the front of his mask, breathed in, felt the smallest trickle of cool air on his face, and realized that they were all very close to dying. He reached over, trying not to move too quickly, trying to keep the grey fog to the edge of his sight. He pushed Sasha. Her slumped form shifted, but did not stir. He tried to move his legs, to slide down into the space beneath the turret. They would not move. They simply would not move. He looked at his hand, wondering for a dreamlike second if it too would refuse to move.
Shornell, he said carefully. Can you reach Mori in the drive cradle?
I think so.
She began to crawl across the floor. Empty shell casings rolled under her. Inch by inch, she moved out of sight. Cord kept the Vox open all the while, trying to take very, very shallow breaths. The minutes bled slowly past.
I'm here.
Shaunal was breathing hard.
Maury?
He asked.
Not moving, sir.
I'll try and wake him.
He's gone, sir.
Gone?
There is blood all over his eyepieces. Thrown!
She swore, and Cord tensed. The grey clouds grew. He fought his heartbeat down.
There's blood on the controls, sir. His face. He must have slammed into the rig when we took a hit.
Can you see the controls?
Asked Cord, measuring out the words.
Yes.
There is a lever. A red lever just beside the controls. You see it?
Yes.
Pull it.
The noise of a faint clank reached him. Then another. Then nothing.
Sir!
Try it again, he said.
A pause. Another clank. Another silence. He heard her try and take a breath. How many more times can she try before she passes out, he wondered. Grey drifted across his narrowing world.
These machines are supposed to have hearts that beat forever, he thought.
Clank.
But all hearts could fail.
Clank. He closed his eyes. Clank. War Anvil woke with a shudder of power. Air spluttered across his face and he gasped. He coughed. The fresh air burned as it filled his lungs. He breathed. And breathed and breathed as War Anvil's engine plant shook its hull. Relief flooded through him. He looked at his hands, flexed the fingers, and found that he could move his legs. He glanced at the firelight, still spilling through the armor glass vision slits. They had to get moving. He slid out of his seat. He would have to unplug his air until he was in the drive cradle. He took a deep breath and snapped the hose free. A stab of panic gripped him as the air cut out. He dropped into the crawl space under the turret, his feet sliding briefly on the brass cases of shells. Shaunal sat next to the driver position, her chest heaving as she swallowed down air. Maury's corpse hung half in and half out of the drive cradle. Blood had dribbled from his suit's broken eyepieces and dried in sticky brown runnels on his suit. The breath he was holding in his chest had started to ache, and he could feel the grey fog pushing at the edge of his sight again. He slotted his air hose into place, heard the valve clink open, and breathed again. He looked around. He could see the unmoving shape of Saul, the Ford gunner, hanging from the demolisher niche. He looked down to Shaunal. She was breathing more steadily now.
Have you ever driven a machine?
He asked.
No.
She shook her head. He nodded, and pulled Maury's corpse out of the drive cradle. It lolled, the dead weight almost pulling him down as he lowered it gently.
Go check all of the others. Wake them if you can.
She nodded and began to crawl towards Saul in the Ford gun niche. Cord lowered himself into the drive cradle and looked at the controls. It had been over 2 decades since he had steered a tank. There was blood on the sight block and control levers. It stuck to his hands as he took hold of them.
Saul's alive, said Shaunal. So is Cog and Zaid, though they're still out.
Sasha?
I can't tell.
He could hear the hesitation in her voice.
Well, get into the turret, he said. Watch the ore specs and Vox.
He turned back to the controls. The assault tank was larger, heavier, and more powerful than anything he had driven before. He glanced through the forward viewfinder. The augmented display had dimmed the light of the fires to near black, but he could see the wreck of a machine directly in front of them. Flames gushed from its hatches, and its front armour ended in a twisted ruin. A white blaze, somehow still visible through the soot and flame, ran down the dead machine's flank. Mourner, he recognised without having to think. Abbas's battered old face floated in his mind as he watched the flames. Slowly he engaged War Anvil's power, and the tank moved forward, gradually, at first, and then with heavy purpose.
Colonel,
Shawnell's voice cut through his concentration. There is something moving out there. Ice pulsed from his heart. One of the enemy had survived, or another ambush group had come to see what had happened to the first.
War Anvil?
The tired voice came over the vox.
War Anvil, this is Razor. Respond, War Anvil.
Cord felt his hand shaking on the controls.
Origo?
Sir.
Razor is still going.
Still alive, sir.
Yes. Anyone else?
The pause spoke the truth before Origo put it into words.
No other signs of life.
Another pause.
We were going to head north. I didn't think anyone else was alive until War Anvil's plant started up.
Cord nodded, then realized no one could see. The fatigue that had been hidden beneath adrenaline began to nudge back into his limbs and thoughts. With it came another thought, one that he did not want to look at now. The thought that he had done exactly what Abbas had feared. He had killed almost everyone who had trusted him.
North,
he said.
There's supposed to be a shelter up on the edge of these flats. At least if we are where I think we are.
All right, Cord said. North, lead us out.
Sir,
replied Origo. Cord began to feed power into the tracks again.
And Origo.
The words came without him deciding to say them.
Yes, Colonel.
Thank you.
Harend ran into the flames, his strides powdering stone to dust. His melter guns were singing. The blast wave from the Baneblade's death hit him. The world vanished in fire and the hail ring of shrapnel. His shields fizzed as they reduced the debris to fire and dust. He could taste his weapon's need to burn. He could feel the death of metal in the ring of shrapnel. He was burning, drowning in iron. He was running down the slope towards the spreading shockwave of the Baneblade's death. Gorton was running beside him, a wet roar bubbling from his speaker units. The rest of the Silaros accelerated across and down the valley floor. Each of them had a pattern of attack, and a set of secondary patterns and target priorities. The trio of predators were already firing, conversion beamers and las cannons reducing the surviving battle tank from the Baneblade's guard to a scream of light and shattering metal. Auron and the two Venators were shifting position on the high ground. They would be ready to fire again in 6 seconds. Directly in front of Harend, one of the enemy squadrons was pulling around. A pulse of las energy hit the stone beneath his stride. Rock splinters hit his shields, flashing to powder. The dust rattled against his skin. He saw the long barrel of a vanquisher turn towards him. It promised an end, a chance to rest from war, to let go of iron. But it would never fire. Harend jinked to the side, raised his arms, fingers splayed. The vanquisher was 20 strides away. The barrel of the cannon was a black circle in his eyes. 2 spears of white heat leapt from his hands. The cannon barrel melted as it fired. The blast blew out the top and back of the vanquisher's turret. He ran directly at the wreck. Behind it, 2 more battle tanks were turning, hunting for targets. The air was hissing with gunfire, screaming as the fire rose to stain the clouds above. A scout tank came around the wreck of the dead vanquisher. It was fast, and the human piloting it had reacted faster than Harend had estimated. That was a mistake. Harend leveled his hand, the energy built in his palm. Inside his cocoon of iron, he felt the heat spill up his nerves. It felt impossible. It felt like being alive again. Gorton hit the scout an instant before Harend was going to fire. Drill claws screamed into armor plate as the other dreadnought shunted the tank across the ground. Its tracks shredded free from its wheels as it gouged through snow and stone. It struck a boulder, and for a second Gorton reared up above it. The teeth of his drill claws glittered in the red rolling light. Gorton slammed his claws down. Tatters of metal fountained up. Hull plates tore. Harend could see a figure in a bulky suit scrabbling inside the split hull. Then the poisoned air found a weakness in the suit, and the figure juddered as his flesh became jelly. Gorton reached into the wreck's guts, and his claws pinched shut.
A ball of flame enveloped the other dreadnought, but Gorton was standing, wrenching the burning wreck into the air. Herend heard his brother's roar spill through the vox and air. Then he realized that he was screaming too, running on, his machine form flowing as if it were his own muscle, and as if it were following a hunger he had not realized he had, a hunger to live again, a hunger to live and burn. He killed the next tank with his hands. It was trying to turn, its tracks churning rock fragments in its wake. He struck it in the side, one hand clamped around its turning tracks and ripped backwards. A shattered length of track arced into the air above him. The tank slewed as its other tracks spun it into a circle. Herend shook as the machine's bulk slammed into him. He punched downwards, just behind the block of a side sponson. The welded join shattered. Herend gripped and fired his melter. Molten armour bored into the machine's heart and out of the other side. In his sarcophagus, Herend thought he could taste cooking flesh. Herend stepped back. The wreck slewed to stillness. Flames were spewing from its back in a bright crest. He stood for a second looking at the dead machine. The battlefield seemed almost silent. The sounds of explosions a dull rumble, like the crash of distant waves. He knew where each of his machines was, but everything seemed remote, as though something had just been unplugged from his awareness. To his left, the Predator trio were moving in deliberately erratic patterns on the lower slopes. Las cannon lights flicked from their sponsons. The Venators were shifting firing position again. Yarvak's machine was still on the opposite side of the valley, hidden from sight behind the wall of fire and smoke. They had torn the enemy force in half for no loss. The battle plan had unfolded exactly as it should have. Except something was wrong. Something that had nothing to do with whether they would survive this fight. Something was calling him. Something within him. Something that perhaps had always been there. Iron within. He could feel it gripping, pulling him in with a relentless strength, with his own strength. It felt like the promise of air when drowning. It felt like life. Iron without. And he wanted to let go. He wanted to let it become. He wanted to feel alive again. He wanted to be more than a corpse clad in iron. He felt his limbs start to move. The Stormlord broke from the curtain of flame. Herend twisted aside as the machine rammed through the wreck of the machine he had just killed. The hull hit Herend with armor-cracking force. He fell, his senses filling with blinking warning runes. He hit the ground, gouging a track across the earth. He stopped and began to rise. The barrels of the Stormlord's megabolter were turning faster and faster. One of Herend's predators on the valley side was dead ahead of the spinning barrels. Herend pulled a leg beneath him. There was oil on the ground, dribbling from his iron frame, black flecks pattering on dirty snow. The muzzles of the Stormlord's guns were a blur. The predators were breaking, scattering across the slope, their guns turning to point at the Stormlord. Herend stood. Amber warning runes painted his sight. His shields were gone. He felt pistons twist and gears snap. They felt like broken bones and shredding muscle. He charged. The megabolter fired. Shells breathed from the spinning barrels. The side of the valley vanished. Rock, dust and shrapnel spread in a roaring cloud. Shell casings sprayed from the Stormlord, raining on its hull as they fell. The Predators struggled on for a second, their armour distorting as round after round chewed into their hulls. Herend saw the status runes of the three Predators pulse to amber and then blink to red. He began to run towards the Stormlord. Herend had shut off his audio sensors when the first shot was fired, but he could still hear the megabolter. It shook the fluid-filled dark of his coffin and into his skull like the roar of an iron dragon. He raised his hands to fire. At the edge of his sight, he saw two of his Venators moving, trying to outrun the storm of gunfire which churned the slope. They would fail. The megabolter was simply cutting Herend's force to pieces. The Stormlord twisted back, tracks screaming and shattering stone. A sponson gun swiveled to point at Herend. He fired. The shells slammed into his torso. Fire swallowed his sight. He staggered, his charge faltering. Shell impacts slammed through him. Blood seeped into the ammonium around his body. More rounds struck, ringing his world to shrill silence. Part of him, the part which had been forged and trained to war, felt everything and catalogued it dispassionately. The Stormlord's main gun was not firing at him. If it was, he would already be dead. It was a heavy bolter. Its shells were substantial but not potent enough to crack his armour. Yet they could batter him down, hammer him to kneeling, shatter his senses and leave him blind. They were not firing to kill him. They were firing to hold him until the main gun could turn and reduce him to shards and blood slime. That moment was coming, winding down into certainty with each second he was not moving. He began to stand, fists raised, forearm plates reverberating as the bolter shells exploded against them. His senses were blurring with threat markers and damage readings. The fire ceased. He took a step forward, his sight cleared. The Stormlord was pivoting its spinning barrels, glowing cherry red as they dragged fire down the slope, down towards him. He took another step, damaged servos wailing as he began to level his guns. He willed the missile free from his carapace. Nothing, just a sparking blank feeling of blown connections. A wedge-shaped hull broke from the screen of fire behind the Stormlord. Scorches marked the brushed metal of its plating. Haren saw a trio of targeting lasers glimmer in the ash-thickened air. "Master!" called Yarvak's voice across the vox, and, as though the word were a command, the Sycoran fired all of its weapons. The back of the Stormlord exploded in a gout of black smoke. The vast machine lurched, its tracks still turning for an instant before becoming still. Promethean flames spread up its back as it rocked to stillness. It was not dead, though. Not yet. It fired all of its guns, panning them across the ground around it like a half-blind warrior trying to fend off attackers. Haren ran, feeling the damage to his frame dig deeper. This was foolishness. It was not optimal, and it was nowhere near rational. But he was no longer seeing the world through those eyes. He was the iron within, and he could feel more than he ever had, more than he had in life. He was a weapon, and a weapon could only live by killing. He hit the front of the Stormlord and bounded up the sloped front, fist rising. A spear of heat struck the cannon, a sphere of molten metal sprayed outwards. It hurt him. The plates of his armour cratered and blistered. He punched into the wounded Stormlord's hull, gripped onto sagging metal and fired his melter gun. And the world became silent whiteness. Frost flashed over Taldak. Argonis felt his own teeth clamp shut as the air became like tar. The iron warrior juddered where he stood. Pale mist rose from him. Argonis thought he could see faces and open mouths in the vapour. Taldak's helm was shaking in its socket. A smell of burning hair and honey flooded Argonis's mouth and nose. He gagged. Taldak's arms began to rise, straining as though against a great weight. Prophesius's fingers were glowing where they touched the iron warrior's helm. Argonis saw the shadows of bones and blood vessels within the astropath's hand. Taldak began to turn, slow, heavy fingers reaching for Prophesius's arm, bolt gun rising. Argonis stepped forward and clamped his own hands around Taldak's arms. It was like touching lightning. He blanked out. When he came to, he was kneeling on the lift platform. The motionless shape of Taldak lay before him, fuming oily smoke. He pulled his helm off and sucked a deep breath of air. It tasted of bitter iron.
"That was foolish," said Sota Nul to him.
She was bent over an open panel on the platform. Prehensile cables snaked from her robes and buried themselves inside the opening. The platform jolted to a halt. Prophesius was standing 3 paces away, utterly still, as though he had not moved. The iron-masked astropath raised his wax tablet as Argonis looked at him. A silver-spiked finger flickered across the tablet.
"He lives," wrote Prophesius,
scraping the words clean as he finished.
"He dreams in the cradle of sharpness and delight. He will wake, and he will remember nothing. I will stay. I will watch him in his dreams."
Argonis nodded.
Relief and revulsion washed through him. He reflexively reached for the key to Prothesius's mask and found it still there, hanging within the gorget of his armour. Sotanul gave a low hiss, which sounded strangely like pleasure, and doors set into the wall of the shaft opened. Argonis stood. The space beyond was dark, but he could taste charge on the air, the hum of power conduits and machines pressed upon the exposed skin of his face. He slid his gladius free, thumb hovering over the activation stud.
"You predicted guards," he said.
"Most certainly," said
Sotanul, disconnecting herself from the platform and gliding over to his side.
"They will be here."
"If you are wrong, and there are legionaries..."
"There will not be. This is not their domain. Even Perturabo respects that."
"So there will be tech priests. Your kind."
"Not my kind. Weaklings. Creatures of a lower dominion. Fools that happen to follow at the side of our allies. I am of the future. They still are of the past."
Argonis did not know what she was talking about, and he was certain that he did not want to have that ignorance corrected. He stepped through the door. The darkness beyond spread out in every direction. He paused as his eyes gathered the scraps of light from the gloom. A narrow walkway extended from where he stood. Beneath it, empty space dropped down to a distant floor. Vast shapes rose to either side of the walkway. Sparks flashed occasionally across their surfaces, illuminating patches of metal and tangles of cable. These were the data stacks of the sightless Warren. In the previous life of the shelter, they would have held the data records of troops, supplies, and shipping movements, of crusade forces that had mustered and shipped out from the planet. The priests of Mars had laid the core of these great machines in the early decades of the planet's compliance. They had grown since that time, so that now they spread through the charged gloom like mountains. Sotanul slid past him, hissing with anticipation.
"Where do..."
"So new... so untouched," said Sotanul. "You have dreamed so long, but not known how to dream, my children."
She shivered, her robes rustling in the charged air. Argonis followed, feeling the weight of his blade in the cradle of his fingers. Worms of charge squirmed and vanished across his armour. He could hear a deep throbbing buzz vibrating through the air and walkway. They kept moving. The tech priest appeared without warning. Stepping from the shadow of one of the machine stacks, he must have been standing utterly still. Umbilical cables still linked him to the great machine. He blurted a stream of machine code. Weapons, or fingers that were weapons, glinted at the end of his arms. Argonis began to move. Sotanul moved faster. She flew forwards. The air shimmered around her. Oily slicks of light spiralled in her wake. A halo of silver arms spread from beneath her robes. Argonis saw turning blades and injector spikes beneath her robe. Wet flesh glistened with the rainbow sheen of oil. Eyelids blinked over clusters of crystal eyes inside nests of sinew and clockwork. She had no legs, just a column of tangled cables. The tech priest tried to twist aside, lightning building on his fingers. Sotanul hissed. The electricity arced from the tech priest's hand. Sotanul rattled a stream of scratching machine code as she struck. She folded around the tech priest. Her halo of tentacles punched down, and the tech priest stopped moving. Sotanul hung in the air. The twitching body of the tech priest hugged close, cables and articulated arms pulsing and squirming. Dark liquid siphoned down lengths of transparent tubes. Argonis thought he saw arcs of electricity running through the liquid. The tech priest's body began to crumple, its shape seeming to lose structure and substance. Sotanul gathered the shrinking ball of its mass into her chest. A wet, pulsing sound washed through the air for a long moment. Then she withdrew her array of machine limbs, and the black robes fell back into place. She turned on the spot, the shadowed hole beneath her hood pointing at Argonis. "I said," he began, but the tech witch spoke over him.
"The eightfold wheel must be given its due.
It is their work that we do.
She turned away and drifted further down the platform. Argonis felt anger flare inside his thoughts, and then quickly crushed the instinct. Events were rolling now, blinking from instant to instant as time became a pressure wave of momentum. He began to run in Sota Nul's wake. The tech witch was singing, a low, brittle noise which ground against the throb of the data stacks. She turned as she moved, head tilted as though listening. Argonis kept his eyes moving across the shadows. Amber threat markers danced and dissolved into nothing. Sota Nul stopped at last. She floated in place, her sharp-edged song growing, and then she too rose into the air. A pair of silvered tentacles slipped out of her. They squirmed through the air, reaching blindly into space. At last, she stopped and drifted to a panel set high in the cliff face of a machine. Argonis had no idea how she had selected the location or how she had known it was there. The twin tentacles slid out, slithering over the machine's surface and then into sockets. Sota Nul jerked and became rigid. She began to shake. The data stack began to rumble. Argonis felt his hair rise inside the shell of his helm. He sheathed his blade. His bolter was in his hand. His helmet system was pinging warnings into his ears.
"It is,"
called Sota Nul, her voice rolling higher and higher within each word.
"So innocent!"
Amber threat runes were moving across his sight as he turned his head. Out there in the gloom between the stacks, things were moving. "Come on!" he called, the need for silence banished by the need for haste. Sota Nul's whole body was pulsing, swelling and contracting, as though she were breathing in, as though she were swallowing something larger than herself. Argonis could see the shapes of the things moving amongst the stacks, the glitter of machine eyes staring at him. Lines of targeting light began to flicker out through the dark. He raised his bolter. Target runes began to flash between red and amber. "We go now!" he called. Sota Nul shivered and then pulled away, silver tentacles yanking from the stack. She trembled in the air for a second and then began to spiral downwards towards him. Machine voices were rising from the dark. Sota Nul landed and began to glide back towards the lift platform. He followed at a run. "What did you see?" he called, as the metal grating shook beneath his feet. "What did you find?"
"A nothing," she hissed,
her voice dreamlike.
"Nothing?"
The lift shaft opened to greet them. Propheus stood above the still supine form of Taldak. The doors began to close behind them.
"Not nothing," said Sota Nul. "A nothing."
Propheus was scratching words onto his wax tablet.
"Do you wish the Iron One to wake?"
"A nothing,"
Argonis called. Sota Nul nodded slowly.
"An absence," she said. "A void, a thing that is not there."
"Do you wish to wake?
What do you mean?"
"They have lied to you."
"To wake?"
He stood and stared at her for a second. He had known it, had been all but certain ever since he looked in Perturabo's eyes, but he had hoped that he would not find a reason to bring fresh news of treachery to his father. He had hoped that in this war of broken vows, some bonds stayed true. Lights set into the shaft walls were flashing past as they descended. He turned to Propheus and thought of the key to the iron mask cold against his neck. Then he looked back to Sota Nul.
"Tell me," he said.
"No,"
she replied. Her metal snakes working inside the platform's control panels. The platform began to move even faster, sinking into the shaft beneath.
"We must see it."
The platform came to a halt 2 full minutes later. Quietness settled into the air. Argonis found it almost unsettling. His hearts were beating adrenaline-spiced blood through his limbs. Tactical markers were spinning in his sight, telling him that the air was cool here, but tinged with exotic chemicals. Ambient sound was almost nothing, just the distant noise of machinery stirring air. Sota Nul extended a set of metal snakes into the controls beside the door. Sparks and smoke puffed into the air, and the doors opened. The corridor beyond was smooth rockcrete. Bare lumen strips ran down its centre. Another small door of reinforced plasteel lay in the distance. Chipped hazard stripes marked its edges.
"Are you sure?"
he asked, keeping his eyes on the corridor. Sota Nuu glided up beside him, metal tentacles slithering back beneath her robe.
"Yes, this is it. Not the main means of entrance-exit, but it should take us to it. The likelihood of detection is high."
She rotated her head towards him. He found himself imagining a grin hidden beneath the hood.
"You might even have to get your weapons dirty."
"The records gave no indication of what they are keeping here."
"None. Just the name signifier buried under three cipher layers. They called it Black Oculus."
"Black Oculus?"
He let the phrase hang in the air. He glanced back at the still unconscious form of Taldak, and then at Prophesius. He nodded and stepped into the passage. The tech witch and the astropath followed. They moved fast. The next door opened to Sota Nul's touch as she fed it the codes she had culled from the data stacks. More corridors followed, all bare, all quiet. He did not like that. Not at all. The air and light changed the further they went. A haze hung on the edge of sight, blurring the edges of walls and the details of distant objects. Shadows clung to recesses like folds of black cloth, while the lumen strips shone brighter but gave less light. The rhythm and regularity of deserted chambers and silent corridors began to press into his mind. He caught his concentration wandering several times. He would blink and realize he had walked several steps and was not even aware of taking them. Every time he would pull himself back to focused awareness, only for it to drain away. It was difficult to tell if the tech witch was affected, but Prophesius's hands clasped and twitched the further they went. The silence deepened, and the fog in their awareness thickened. It almost killed them. Another hatch door had swung open, and Argonis had been stepping through, gun pointing by habit as much as intent. The iron warrior standing on the other side of the hatch turned, bolter rising. A slowed sensation of shock ran up Argonis's spine. His senses cleared in a cold rush. He kicked the iron warrior's gun. The casing slammed back into the warrior's chest plate. Two rounds roared from the muzzle and hit the wall. Gunshot echoes, dust and smoke flooded the passage. Argonis came forward fast, slamming his fist into the iron warrior three times before he was halfway to the floor. His mind was a sudden focused line, all hot fury and bared teeth. The lenses in the iron warrior's helm shattered, blood misted from the broken sockets with his first and second blow. The iron warrior was falling, most likely blinded, but he was far from dead and brought his gun up as he fell. The decision occurred so fast in Argonis's mind that he was barely aware of its passing. He fired his bolter. The round hit the iron warrior in the chest, exploded, and punched the warrior back into the wall. Argonis fired three times more, once into the throat joint, once into each eyepiece, each shot a sliver of time apart. The iron warrior's head and neck exploded. Argonis moved forward, gun ready, tracking the space beyond the headless corpse. Nothing. Just a section of corridor with another small door in the wall opposite, and a large circular hatch to his left. His helmet display fizzed as he stepped closer to the circular hatch, and then dissolved into a blur. Squawks of distortion rose from his vox. He pulled the helm off and looked back at his two companions. Sota Nuu was already gliding close.
"Very clean,"
she said, the slight twitch of her hood indicating the dead iron warrior.
"Apart from the first instant when he nearly killed you. But the three kill shots, one to ensure the throat and mouth could not call an alarm, the other two to ensure fatality, impressive."
Argonis did not respond. Part of his mind had simply shut off all of his thoughts about what he had just done. He had not wanted to kill the Iron Warrior, but the only other option would have been to die and to fail in his mission.
"We may still have sent an alert," he said, without looking at Sota Nuu.
"He had time to speak before I fired."
"No,"
said the tech witch.
"He sent nothing. His vox was disabled, as were most of his auto-senses."
Why?
Because of this.
She touched the circular hatch as she spoke.
You will have to open it,
she said, and he could hear a tremor in her voice.
I...
she began to say, but the word did not finish, and she drifted to the floor. He noticed Prophetius then. The astropath was still by the door they had entered through. He was trembling. His hand was jumping across his wax tablet, writing the same thing again and again. Black star, black star, black star, black star, black star. Argonis turned back to the hatch. A wheel sat at its centre. He could see no other lock, just the blank space and loose cables where an access system had been. He reached out and gripped the wheel. His armour was moving with slow creaks and groans of resistance, as though its system were failing. He began to turn the wheel. It spun until he heard a heavy clank from within. Then he pulled the hatch, his protesting armour grinding as he heaved it wide. The space beyond was dark, and the light coming from behind Argonis halted at the door as though a barrier prevented its passing. He stepped across the threshold. The dark closed over him. For a heartbeat, he could see nothing. Then his eyes adjusted, and a scene of stark monochrome formed in front of him. Thin human figures hung from frames of metal. Chains, hooked into loops, bonded to their arms and scalps. Some bore mutations, additional limbs of shriveled muscle and stark bone, translucent scales, back-jointed legs, fingers grown to crescents of pale bone. A thick metal band circled each of their heads. Needle-tipped tubes connected their bare skin to bottles of liquid. A turn of his head told Argonis that there were dozens of them in the chamber. His eyes ached as he looked at them, and a dull crackle hummed in his ears. He knew what they were, or at least what they had been. They were navigators. Dozens of navigators, chained in the dark and sedated. He stepped closer. His armour was a dead weight, pulling against his muscles. The first figure he reached was a starvation-thin woman. Slowly he pulled the needles from her flesh. He waited, feeling the instincts in his spine and limbs telling him to get back into the light. He waited. And time waited with time. The navigator's head came up. She gasped air to scream. Then she went still, then tilted her head first one way and then another. Argonis did not move or speak.
I see you,
she said, and her voice was a cold shiver of sound.
I see you, son of the Moon Wolf.
What are you? He asked.
What are we? We are those who have looked into the light of eternity. We are the ones who have seen the Black Star.
Black Star. Black Star. Black Star. The words repeated in his thoughts, trailing down to silence. The Black Star, he asked, and found that his lips were dry.
The dark heart of all things. It was there. And we passed into it and through it, our eyes wide. And we saw...
The navigator's voice caught, and for a second terror trembled her words.
We saw all things. The Black Star. The circle beneath. The gateway to the gods. The Eye of Terror sees all.
She turned her head and looked at Argonis. He felt the look. It felt like ice, like falling. And falling without ever finding the release of the ground.
It is here. It is within. And...
she was trembling again, limbs shaking the frame that bound her.
And it is looking back at us.
He left the chamber and closed the hatch on the darkness and the sleeping navigators within. Sotanul had withdrawn to the hatch they had entered by. Her shape was swelling and deflating as he watched her, and there was no sign of either the corpse or the blood which had spattered the floor and walls. Argonis walked towards them, his armour moving more freely with each step he took from the door.
"We have to reach the Iron Blood,"
he said, as he ducked into the passage that led back the way they had come.
"We have to reach Perturabo."
Io was listening to Argonis when her awareness snapped away from the emissary. The part of her mind watching the rest of her feeds had noticed something. This was not supposed to happen. She was in a deep focus meditation. Only something that could be an immediate personal threat could trigger a switch. The image of a corridor filled her eyes. It was deserted except for a lone man, standing still, looking up into the eyes of her netfly. Looking into her eyes. The man wore grey overalls marked with the numbers of the Iron Warrior's labour carders. His scalp was clean-shaven, his stare blank and unblinking. He smiled, lips moving as though pulled at the corners by wires. A swirl of colour tattoos bloomed on his face, and then faded as the smile slid down his face again.
"Be careful, assassin," he said.
"There are only so many places to hide, and what might appear safe might be otherwise."
He smiled again, reached up, and the image became static. She felt the netfly die. Shock flooded her. It took several seconds for the conditioned routines to kick in. "Data, netfly presence compromised." She performed a blink-fast inventory of her swarm and found all the rest in place and functioning. "Projection. Subject who made approach wished to invoke psychological intimidation." She began to flick through the netflies that watched over her bolt holes within the sightless warren. After three, she began to find the messages. Scratched, daubed, or chalked within sight of her netflies was a symbol, the first letter of the alphabet in a dialect of Old Terra, an alpha. She had to pause before she began to process these facts. She had kept subconscious watch on each of the bolt hole locations that had been marked, and she had not seen anything.
"Projection. The enemy is not trying to intimidate. The enemy is trying to communicate sophistication and superiority."
She was aware of her own breathing, aware of the narrowness of the vent she had folded into, aware of everything, and aware that she was shivering.
"You are making an error."
Io started at the sound, and then realized she had spoken aloud.
"No, no, not now," she thought.
And suddenly her mind was tumbling out of her control. She had been warned about it. They all had. Even a Vanus mind could only take in so much data for so long before it began to clog and misfire. Extended mission conditions and overly complex problem spaces could induce a chaotic state in which the mind walked down its own compulsive paths. Io had been living within a supremely complex problem space for months.
"Demand. List known psychological qualities of the 20th Legionis Astartes. Designation Alpha."
She was speaking out loud. She could not help it. The old face of her mentor was grinning at her from her memory, and she catapulted through a loop of question and response that she had not begun and could not stop.
"Response. Known psychological qualities include superiority / inferiority complexes, sublimated into complex psychopathic behaviour, requiring the acknowledgement of superiority by an enemy and or ally. Demand. Project data of recent confrontation in line with this data and previous mission data. Projection. The Alpha Legion know I am here. They want me to know who they are. They want me to know how good they are. They want me to know before they kill me."
The memory of her mentor's cruel smile was there again, just inside her eyelids. She was shaking, her contorted muscles aching, but her mind was clearing. She was out of the fugue. Crucial time had passed, but she was still whole, still alive, still functioning. She began to touch the strings of her computations again, tentatively at first, then hauling them back into her awareness. She had lost time, and time was a deadly factor in a problem space. She looked again through her eyes and blinked back to the netflies following Argonis and Sotanul. They were moving to the lift. She was still uncertain exactly what Argonis's discovery meant. The implications were vast in their potential, and the projected possibilities were equally vast. She needed time, and for that she needed to cut away the agency of some of the actors. She performed a quick mental check, assured herself that her action would not have fatal consequences, and decided to change what she was seeing. Carefully, she fed a message into the Iron Warrior's security systems. It was a tiny thing, just a seed that would grow into something greater. The first security alarms began to ring out 3 minutes later.